Here's a controversial one. I suppose it's sort of, you know, it's different for most people. But if I could essentially go back in time and meet an 18-year-old me, I would tell him.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast, your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the GameDevAdvice.com website. So let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice. Today's guest is Scott Millard, Managing Director of Feardemic, a video game publisher and wholly owned subsidiary of the Bloober team. Previous to this, he's held various game industry positions, including the Asian distribution of Bethesda Games, Managing Director of Namco Bandai Partners Singapore and Namco Bandai Partners Korea Limited, the co-founder of a Korean games association, plus other roles. And as a heads up, this was recorded during the pandemic, and there are some noises at times in the background as we've all adjusted to working from home. So thanks for your patience with that. Plus a quick shout out to my good friend and listener, Matt Hale.
Hey, Scott. How are you doing tonight?
I'm great. Yourself?
I'm doing really good. Thank you. So where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from a place in Poland called Krakow, and it's the second largest city in Poland, the capital being Warsaw.
Right.
And, it's a small city, a medieval city, and probably one of the most popular cities for tourists to come. But, of course, we haven't had many of those for the past year or so. Yeah. But you probably noticed by my name and by my accent that I am not Polish, but I am one of the many foreigners that are working here in Poland as part of the game development industry. And, you know, it really is a vibrant industry, a really interesting industry here. There's a lot more to it than just CD Projekt. And I mean, I know everyone around the world sort of thinks Poland CD Projekt,
right?
You know, there is hundreds of game development studios here. You know, I think last count I was reading it was about 440.
Studios.
Wow. There are a few publishers here as well.
Yeah.
You know, Playway, as being one, and of course ourselves. But generally, there's probably about 10,000 people employed all up in the sector, and it generates around about, I think I was reading a couple of weeks ago, about 470 million euros a year in revenues for the country. So, you know, the government here look upon it very favorably when it comes to earning taxes.
No, that's fantastic. And I had no idea the industry was that big over there. Wow, 10,000 people working in the industry. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I think one of the big strengths of the Polish games industry is the government has for a very long time taken the sector very seriously. Mm-hmm. And between themselves and the European Union, they've made available significant research and development grants and research and development investments that game studios can apply for.
Right.
And they can apply for those funds to create new patents, to create new tools to make game development easier. Mm-hmm. And as a result, a lot of public money has flown into this sector and has sort of flowed into this sector for quite a while. And it's sort of kind of, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that they're just training people and training people and training people. Those studios grow, the teams break apart, they go create new studios, et cetera, and they either work for higher studios or their original content studios. So, it's just really has become a self-fulfilling prophecy for the whole tech sector here. And, you know, there's something sort of really creative about the Polish people, and there's also something that pushes them to work really hard and to focus on a global opportunity. So it's kind of weird. It's like the intersection of a culture and a new technology and you know, a school system that, you know, has really, you know, held up mathematics as a sort of a, you know, as a sort of a key pillar, which is all that translated into just a whole lot of games.
And that's smart, because to fund things and help with that infrastructure, it does mushroom and grow. And, you know, these are well-paying jobs, and it's technology, and it's the future, and it's that's wild to hear. And being half Polish, that's kind of cool. So
I was really stunned. I mean, I remember a year ago I was listening to the BBC, and I heard the technology minister for the technology affairs minister for Poland talking about CD Projekt, and was saying that they represented something like 2% of the country's GDP. It was like one company. It is a very important sector for the government.
How's everything with COVID, and how are you dealing with all those kind of things over there?
Our industry has been incredibly fortunate. You know, we can't sort of complain too much. I mean, we've been able to work through this, and many people haven't been able to work through it. So many people have had to sort of endure, you know, the front lines of it, whether it being, the medical profession or the nursing profession. But we have been able to sort of, you know, keep on going. Yeah. So we can't really complain. We've been very, very fortunate. It'd be wrong to say we haven't been affected, because, you know, certainly we are, you know,
right.
You know, working and living in the same space for 12 months or so, it has, you know, had an effect on people. You know, you can see it. People are really tired of the uncertainty and really tired of, you know, the Zoom calls and, you know, not meeting face-to-face, of course. But, you know, hopefully vaccination will be a sort of a path to fixing that. But but from a production side of things, I mean, I think everyone's different. I mean, I know I've talked to people who've said that, you know, they've really enjoyed it from a creative perspective. They've been able to focus on their 3D modeling or their environment designs and be able to focus on that without sort of having these interruptions all the time, like you would in the office environment.
Right, yeah.
But you know, I have noticed, I don't know whether everyone else has had this sort of experience though, but a few people have agreed with me here. In that last mile where you usually are doing all your QA runs and really sort of getting everything prepped for release and going to final master, that's when it starts all coming apart. Because well, certainly has for some people I've been speaking to, and in our case, I suppose as well, it's that point in the game development cycle requires a lot of communication. It requires people to sort of understand who's checking what, who's looking at what, and you know, it really helps to have that face to face or sort of that in real life contact with people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that quick kind of iteration where you're like, hey, what's this? What's that? Let's go fix that thing. All right, let's do a new build. And it's landing the plane, or as we used to say, it's coming in hot, right? So if it's coming in hot and the communication's a little bit fractured, or a lot fractured because of distance and things, that could be a little tricky, I guess.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's been a lot of slippage this, you know, at the end of 2020, and, you know, coming into the beginning of 2021. So, and I think that's kind of a result of that, people sort of kind of, you know, getting to that last sort of, the last few milestones and sort of suddenly realizing that, you know, hey, this is not going to be as easy remotely as, you know, we thought it was going to be. So we're going to have to push the game back. But, you know, other than that, I mean, you know, I think it's okay. I am very much looking forward to, you know, getting back to an office though.
Can you tell me about your current role?
I look after a publisher called Feardemic, and we are a single vertical publisher, and we specialize in games that have a horror narrative. I mean, this is kind of not that unusual, I suppose. Paradox is a company that focuses on strategy, and we are one that focuses on a horror narrative. Now, oddly, horror is not necessarily a genre. It is more of a narrative, because you can find horror injected into almost any genre of game. You know, often sort of dare people to find me a genre or a game that doesn't have a horror narrative. They say sport, and I say Blood Bowl. So anyway, and that thesis actually comes from the fact that we are a wholly owned subsidiary of another company that people might know called Bloober Team. And Bloober Team, of course, Blair Witch, The Medium, Layers of Fear, Layers of Fear 2, The Observer. So, again, a company that here in Poland is actually quite large, and they're a listed public company here. They've had a long and positive experience with, you know, psychological horror. Now, Feardemic, we can play a little bit in the genre. We're not as strictly adhering to a particular style of horror. We are sort of, as a publisher, we are looking at trying to broaden that, have horror games that are targeted towards children or created for children, all the way through to really hardcore horror. The sort of value that we're able to add to developers who are creating horror games is, you know, essentially that, you know, we have some experience with marketing these games and presenting these to a community. And, you know, we've started really building a community that we can now find games that we think that they will enjoy. And over the longer term, it will hopefully make it easier to get eyeballs on games, which is, you know, really, really tough at the moment.
When I think of horror, right, Resident Evil is always the one that kind of jumps to mind. And how
right, and that's an adventure game. it's odd because, you know, if you look at all the genres in gaming, and you always have the, you know, adventure game, FPS, and sport racing, there's no horror. But if you look at movies, of course, there is a horror genre.
Yeah.
It is a genre, but in games, it's more of a narrative. So at present, we've got about six different IPs. I mean, you know, Feardemic's not a old company. It's a fairly new idea. It's only been sort of percolating for the last 2 years now. And we've got about six different games. The last one we did with a developer from California called Unfold Games, and that was Dark Complete Edition. We've launched that across all of the current gen platforms: PS5, Series X, Switch, PS4, Xbox One account. So that has done very well for us in the first quarter, and getting games out on those platforms was really quite satisfying for us. And we've got quite a few in the pipeline. So we're really excited to announce a couple. We're announcing one today, actually, that we've just signed, a game called Dark Fracture, which we're really excited.
Wow. No, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a really robust narrative in gaming. And, I mean, it's probably about, I mean, we've looked at how to sort of, you know, tease out the numbers for you know, games that have horror in the narrative. And it's almost about 20%. If you look at across the board, at all games, about 20% of them, you can absolutely clearly identify them as having some type of horror or disturbing thread that goes through them. It doesn't restrict us at all.
So how did you get started in the game industry, and how did you get over to Poland? Two questions.
How many hours do you have? You know? I have been in the games industry a very, very long time. And actually, strangely enough, I got to games via music. I started working for a company called Warner Music. And, the music was really my first love, my first passion. And I was, you know, heading up sales in Sydney, Australia. And at that particular point in time, there was another company called Sega, which were just starting to sell to some of the big music retailers. And one thing led to another. And after a trip around the world, I came back and fell into working with Sega because I obviously knew a lot of the new customers that they wanted to work with. So that's how I got started in gaming, and from there.
When was this, early 90s, mid 90s?
Yeah, it would have been. It was in the 90s. It was in the sort of, you know, early to mid 90s, and Sega was then, which was called Sega AussieSoft actually in Australia, it was then purchased by Infogrames, who then changed their names. Yep, who then changed their name to Atari, and then was then sold to Namco Bandai, and I was there for the whole thing. It was a very, very, I've been in the games industry a long time, and, I've almost spent my entire life selling some type of media or involved with some type of media, whether it be games or music, so I've never done anything else.
So looking back now, what do you wish you had known when you'd started?
Here's a controversial one. I suppose it's sort of is different from most people. But if I could essentially go back in time and meet an 18-year-old me, I would tell him, do not work for large companies. They are traps. So, you know, and it's kind of really true. I know a lot of people who work for Microsoft and Sony probably don't want to hear this, but, mm-hmm. you know, you fool yourself into sort of thinking to yourself that, you know, hey, I'm working for these big companies who are doing big business in this sector. I'm going to learn a lot. But really, the only thing you learn is dependency. Mm. And, you know, I spent decades, over a decade working for big public companies. And, yeah. I mean, look, it's easy to get trapped there. And you know, oddly, until you leave them, you don't really realize that you don't learn a lot of things when you're there. You essentially go through the whole, you know, you get promoted, you do all these things, you move departments from marketing to the C-suite, but your job description is really tiny and you can lose so much time. And look, it's great flying around the world to meetings and having a nice office and, you know, a logo on a card that everyone goes, wow. But that's the trap. That is the trap. You know, I would recommend to a younger person now and a younger me to just find your own way. Do what you want to do and focus on building something that you want to build rather than doing it for somebody else. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of advice that I would give to people. I don't think that there is anything but dependency when it comes to working for a larger company.
It's changed a lot in the sense it used to be very gated and it had to be like, if you wanted to get a game out, it had to go in a box and you had to have to go through the big publisher and they had to pay for the end cap or otherwise you didn't get the marketing. And it's now been so much more democratized with so many other avenues and ways of doing things. It's not that kind of rigid model that it was back in the early 90s, I think.
Yeah, that there's a lot of truth to that. And I suppose every piece of advice sort of comes with a disclaimer about depending on when, what, you know, timing is everything, right? So, mm-hmm. So now that piece of advice might be a lot easier to sort of imagine. But back in the day, you're right. I mean, it was pretty much, there was a huge barrier to entry. There was no indie games at all. Everything was like either AAA, single A, double A, or B. you know, it was categorized in this sort of funny way. And when I first went to Sega, you know, everyone was wearing a tie and a suit. It was really, really, it was the IT business. It was a very, very different time. But I still I still think that, you know, if I went back there and had that opportunity to talk to myself, I would say, don't do this. Mm-hmm. Don't do this. You know, you're you know, too much time will disappear. And time, when you're young, you sort of think, oh, I've got heaps of it, you know. But that's kind of a falsity.
I was at NEC, which had the TurboGrafx division and, you know, a big, giant global corporation. And, I had to wear a tie 4 days a week. We had casual Fridays back when that was a thing. But, so you were at Sega wearing a tie, and I was at NEC wearing a tie. And that was just the way it was, which is kind of crazy when you think back to that. What about advice for trying to advance your career, and you're a managing director right now, right? So what kind of thoughts do you have for somebody in the industry right now wanting to keep progressing and moving forward and maybe focusing on the publishing side?
I think, you know, the number one piece of advice, that the best piece of advice that I've ever heard, that anyone's ever given me, is the most important thing that you can do and you can get good at is finding access to capital. That is the major difference between a company that is successful and a company that's not successful. So you've got to find partners, you've got to find business partners, investors that are able to sort of give you the freedom to focus on, you know, the thing that you do best. Now, I see that from a lot of developers all the time. They have this dream to make a game. It is a really credible dream. They've got a really great idea, mm-hmm. but they don't have the capital to make that a reality. Right. On the other hand, you see it all the time. You see some really kind of mediocre ideas, but they have access to capital, so they can make it work. They can push it through. They can mm-hmm. iterate it and keep on iterating it until it works. Right. So this is the trick. And you know, I wish I could tell you that there was some type of formula to finding that access to capital. But that access to capital really is, you know, some people can never find it their entire life. Others sort of stumble upon it. Mm-hmm. And it's either a high net worth individual, it's some luck with an earlier investment, or your first investment pays out, so suddenly you have your own access to capital. Right. But this is kind of the most important thing. And a lot of games, start up because they've been able to mortgage the house, or go to an uncle who's able to get their first lump
friends
of capital,
and family.
Friends and family, and push that capital into the creation of the game. Because you go to a publisher and say, a lot of people think, I just need to find a publisher and they will pay for everything. And not really. That's not really how it kind of works. It's especially these days. If it's a big publisher and that publisher has got a lot of money, if you've got a good idea, their number one priority is buying that idea and buying you. Mm-hmm. So they own you, which right. I suppose is an okay outcome. But if you don't want that to happen, the second tier of publishers, the smaller publishers like ourselves, we're looking for really sort of creative guys that have already, I suppose, got something that is playable. And to have something that's playable, whether it be a vertical slice, or whatever they've had to spend some money and time on it, then the second part of that is, have they been able to energize a community? Have they been able to, get players interested or engaged with what it is that they're doing via community, via the Discord channels, et cetera? And all that takes some type of investment. Yeah. And that money's got to come somewhere. So, again, going back to that key piece of advice is find access to capital. No matter who it is, rich uncle, someone you've worked with or someone you've met, keep looking for it. And no matter how big you get, even if your company's turning over 20 million, that's nothing. It's still tiny, right? For you to do your next project, you're still going to need access to capital. So, again, be out there pitching, looking all the time. Always have your deck ready to go in your briefcase if you come across somebody who you think may be able to help you with it.
So, as a publisher, what are you looking for in a game or in a pitch or that kind of thing?
I get that question all the time from developers. What is it that's going to make you say yes and invest in our game? And really, there is no formula. If there was a formula, EA would have worked it out, and there would be no games industry, and it would just be EA. Essentially, what we're looking for is the people. I have made some errors in the past and sort of gone with, they're just here, we'll just go with that. I'm sure we'll be able to beat it into shape later. But, the reality is, the thing is, you're looking for people who are able to plan out a game. So the game development document is really, really important. That's the first place you'll get some insight into what the developers are thinking, how are they working, who of the small team is in charge and who's doing what, who's thinking about the big picture. So that's really, really important. And also the second is finding a human connection with them. And again, I suppose it's like building a studio. The founder of Bloober Team, Peter Babiano, told me, I was telling him, well, perhaps we can build our own studio. He says, well, yeah, it's really hard. Not that easy. And that's why they're worth so much money as an acquisition, because to get the team working together in a really creative sort of good flow is difficult. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at a smaller project or an indie project, maybe their first game, maybe their second game, you're looking for sort of hints that this team are going to be able to pull it off over the next 2 years, and that you're going to be able to add some value to that, and they're going to be able to accept that value. So it's not a mathematical formula. It's not obviously there's skills involved. If they've been able to create a fantastic vertical slice or a fantastic demo, that gives you again that hint that it could work. This is going to work. Yeah. But there's still more to it than that. It's very much a case of looking and meeting these people, talking to these people, trying to work out, okay, if I put all my money on the table here, we have got a good chance of getting to the end, because a lot of stuff can happen, you know, in two years, especially when you have a small team with four or five people that, you know, are all having different issues in their life, you know, paying bills and doing that and, you know, thinking about working for a big company and, you know, a lot of things can happen. So, you know, there's a big danger that, I mean, I've spoken to other indie publishers as well, and, you know, it's often talked about sort of like the amount of games that you announce that you don't actually deliver because the dev team implodes halfway through the development.
Yeah, to get everybody firing on all cylinders and everything working, it's tough to orchestrate, right? Because there's so many inputs, there's so many variabilities with people and design and pandemic now. I mean, it's just so much stuff going on. And you talk about the people too. Like, are you looking for people with like a proven track record, or just people with a good documentation and a good pitch, and that you get a good kind of gut reaction, you know, when they come to you?
Hey, hope you're enjoying the show. If you are, please go to patreon.com/gamedevadvice. We'd love to see if you can support the show and help new episodes keep coming out. That's patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Thanks.
Track record's not necessarily always an indicator of, you know, what's to come. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at our industry especially, you can find a lot of developers. That came out of, you know, shops like Blizzard or you know, Epic, for example, that found huge amounts of capital from you know, investors in Korea and Asia to build, set up their own studios and deliver these games that haven't been able to sort of get it to work. Right. So, you know, track record's not necessarily everything. You know, oddly enough, I mean, you know, again, I was speaking to another publisher about this, and, you know, he was saying, yeah, you know, I have this one team that, you know, they are really experienced. They've delivered some huge, huge AAA hits. But you know what? They have, I'm struggling to get them wish lists. Then on the other hand, I've got these guys that are still in game school that have been, you know, got this platform that is being funded by, you know, the school that they go to. And they've got, you know, 20,000 wish lists, and, you know, their Discord channels are on fire, their Facebook pages are on fire. I mean, you know, so it's kind of really strange that, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, that track record that gets you anywhere. But, you know, I think like a lot of independent publishers, what we're looking for is something that's already a spark that's already ignited that we can build upon.
Right.
If that spark is not there, if that magic is not there, if that sort of human touch is not there, if they haven't been able to engage with communities, it's going to be a really uphill battle trying to make that happen. You know, because the only way you can make that happen is by throwing money at it. And, you know, you can just throw money at these things, but the, you know, game,
the seed's not there. Yeah.
The seed's not there, you know, really. It's very, very difficult to ignite.
And you're right, too, like wish lists and social media and all those kind of things. Like, there's so many games out there, and there's just so many things competing for people's eyeballs that you got to have some kind of momentum going already versus just trying to build it from scratch and just showing up with a 400-page GDD and be like, give us money to make this thing. Not that people even do that anymore with 400-page GDDs, but yeah.
Yeah, I know. I mean, everyone sort of says, you know, too long didn't read. but I read them. And, you know, so because, I mean, you know, look, at the end of the day, it's not cheap to make a game. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of this sort of like, well, you know, we'll work it out as we go strategy, because it's not a good way to invest money on a sort of a wing and a prayer. You know, you really need to see, well, what is it that you're trying to achieve here, and, you know, what is the story? Because people actually care about stories, and games are a great medium to tell a story. You need to kind of know what that is and know where you're going with it, what the, you know, what the sort of value proposition is for the user. You know, these things are really important, you know, as well as, you know, how many programming hours you're going to need to actually execute this, how many people you're going to need for QA, how many languages are you going to target, understand what it is that you're doing, and have a sort of a good understanding of, you know, what it is you need to do it. And then, you know, we can come along and help that whole process and really sort of supercharge it.
Right. Having a baseline gameplay, right? You know, you got to have a game plan, and granted, it's going to change and evolve, but there's got to be that foundation. And then, yeah, publishers often help. So you've been involved with a lot of games. Like, what's one or two of your favorite projects?
If you can imagine, when I started in this games industry, I sat down at a desk with my tie on, mm-hmm. and the first thing that came across my desk was a game called Doom 2. And we had the distribution rights for it in Australia. And at that time, you know, Windows was launching, and I picked up the phone, called a retailer, and they said, oh, you know, can we bundle it with Windows? Can you give me 100,000 copies? And I'm like, okay. So, and then the second one was this new IP called Tomb Raider from a company called Eidos. And, you know, we just sort of kind of took delivery of it, went out to retail, and, you know, sold like hotcakes. Then there was another game called Command & Conquer, which came along from Virgin Interactive. you know, and this is what it was like. You know, every time that you'd release something, it was just huge. So it was a really kind of a strange time to work. Now, I mean, obviously things are they're very different because, you know, the barrier to entry is not there as it was back in the old days. And it's interesting to sort of see the games industry, how it's evolved. You know, so it's really hard to sort of say what has been your favorite game to work on. I've got a few unfavorite games I have worked on.
We all have those too. Like, why did I do that? It was terrible.
I mean, there's been some real challenges out there that have sort of arrived on your desk.
And just kind of riffing off that, while I'm thinking about that, it even kind of ties into to horror. I worked for Blue Byte in the later-ish 90s, and I remember Quake was outlawed in Germany. And when I was flying over there, the team would be like, bring a copy, get a box, get a copy of the game, bring it over, because it was contraband in Germany.
Yeah, I come from Australia originally, and there's still a lot of games that get banned there because of our, you know, crazy classification rules. But speaking of classification of stupid things, I mean, you know, Doom 2, I actually manufactured 100,000 copies of Doom 2, and I forgot to put the classification label on it.
Oh, wow.
So we had to hire, you know, and can you imagine, this is my first week at Sega. Yeah. we had to hire a whole army of people to sort of come into the warehouse and sit there and stick these stickers.
And 100,000
copies. 100,000 copies.
What are you curious about right now in the industry?
Google.
Stadia Google, you mean? Or
look, I think, you know, I can't help but be really interested in what's sort of happening here because, I mean, merger and acquisition in the games business at the moment is rife. I mean, Microsoft for the last couple of years have been, you know, really taking the gloves off to ensure that they are, you know, 100-pound gorilla.
Yeah.
And it's what's really interesting. I think everyone believed Google had the resources. All it needed was the will to take on or carve itself out of a position in the lounge rooms of the world.
Yeah.
But what I don't know what scared them away, because they say they feel like it feels like to me that they sort of really
cut bait too early. I think.
Yeah. They saw something and went, you know, we're not going to you know, bloody ourselves in this fight.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, Microsoft's done the total opposite. I think we live in a really interesting time, and I think one of the challenges, so I think, you know, this is sort of kind of the opportunities and challenges in this business is what happens. I mean, as this consolidation happens even more over the next few years, and it will continue to happen, you know, what opportunities is that going to create for publishers and developers, and how can they sort of, you know, craft themselves or position themselves to take full advantage of what's going to happen? And on the other side, that there's, you know, these sort of risks that, you know, games industry will end up like the other entertainment industries, like the film business, where everything just consolidates into these big pipes that, you know, literally it's very difficult to get access to. You're either on YouTube or Netflix, or you're on HBO or somewhere else.
Right, one of the streaming platforms.
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult business to be in, and find your way. So I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting things happening at the moment. And, you know, again, why Feardemic have decided to, you know, focus on one genre and one specific narrative in games. It's really kind of believe we could create ourselves a niche within. And so no matter what happens in the washing machine of the games business, there's always going to be a place for fans of horror to find, you know, good quality horror games as opposed to sort of trying to find them wherever they may be.
Yeah, the brand is affiliated with that and people know, if you buy the Feardemic game, I'm going to have a good experience and it's going to be interesting.
Well, they know what's been, it's been curated in some sort of some form or another.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The other thing that's sort of kind of a big challenge in the games industry that I'm really, really curious about is I have not met a single person that enjoys having 15 different accounts to access their you know, game libraries.
Right.
So, you know, this is not just a challenge in the games business. I mean, it's also a challenge in the movie film business at the moment with all the streaming platforms and the streaming services. And I think there's an enormous opportunity there, but I don't know what the solution to it is. I wish I had. I'd be a gazillionaire. But if there's some way, all that could be consolidated so I didn't have to have, you know, multiple accounts with multiple platforms to access my library. So, I mean, the music industry has sort of solved it, or not really solved it, or Spotify has essentially become the 10,000-pound gorilla and, you know, just essentially sucked up all the content and have said, this is how it's going to work. Everyone's going to have a Spotify account. And essentially, I don't think that that has really worked for the creators in music. They don't earn as much from that platform as perhaps they should.
You're right. For artists, unless you're like ginormous, you're not getting any real money from it. And the challenge was it was a way to get ears and get people to then go see the live show, right? That was kind of like one of the avenues. But now that with COVID, that's changed, although it's starting to come back here. The artists are getting kind of screwed. But then they do invest lots of money in content. They go pay that Yahoo Joe Rogan millions of dollars and all kinds of other things.
It really is a sort of search for the giants to sort of, you know, push the platforms. But it's like Game Pass. I mean, you know, is Game Pass a sustainable business model? Well, I don't really know. I mean, there's been some murmurings from Microsoft saying perhaps not. We're going to have to look at that, look at the structure of that in the future, because, you know, paying big sort of guarantees for, you know, these games that go on Games Pass is not necessarily, you know, the way that Microsoft would perhaps like to do it. They'd like to find another way that sort of represents the demand or the install of each particular game as opposed to, you know, just paying one lump sum for it. Exactly what's going to happen in the games business, but it is super interesting, and I'm really curious to see, you know, how it sort of kind of works out. The chip shortages have really sort of thrown a fox into the hen house, if you like the analogy, because obviously hardware was always a big part of the Sony Microsoft plan, and now it's kind of like, well, what happens if chips, you know, the chip shortage continues for the next 12 to 13 months, and we lose the momentum on the install base. So it's all kind of really interesting.
Yeah, and even the hardcore gamers that are always upgrading their video cards and pushing the edge with what they can do, they can't upgrade their hardware, and maybe they're not going to play as many games, because when you get a new video card, you're always excited to go and like, can I turn on all the settings and, you know, do all that kind of stuff.
They're all in Bitcoin mines.
yeah, they're all doing that. And, so what are your thoughts on AR and VR?
I was a big fan of VR several years ago. I certainly, you know, loved the idea. And I remember trying some at, DICE and GDC 4 or 5 years back now. And it was just, you know, wow, mind-blowing stuff. But it's been very sad to see that it's been very slow to be taken up by end users. I think, you know, there's a lot of great applications for it in business. I mean, we were talking offline earlier about medical applications for VR and AR. You know, absolutely, you know, these are just fantastic platforms for that. But for entertainment and general home use, it sort of really hasn't found its way. I mean, there's some really interesting things out there. I mean, we've been looking for VR games. So obviously Phasmophobia has been huge, and we've been looking at that and thinking, well, maybe we can find something that's out there, and we found a couple of VR games, but you know, making VR games is pretty tricky, and I've sent our marketing guys out to play these games, and they've come back and said, I was vomiting all the way home on the tram. You know?
Right. frame rate. You gotta have
this. So, you know, perhaps just not yet. And I thought, you know, like Minecraft AR might be sort of something that really sort of, you know, changes everyone's perspective on it. But no, it really sort of kind of happened. I know my kids were really excited about Minecraft AR and, you know, downloaded it, and that was it. I haven't touched it since.
And the barriers of entry have always been so high, right? Like, so when the Quest came along, I got really excited just because of the price point, the fact that you don't have to have cameras set up and everything. But then there's that whole Facebook owning the data and that kind of weirdity and tying into an account that is off-putting, to be honest, because I really do find the platform interesting, and I've played around with the SDK. And
yes, we will see. I mean, I'm sure there's a date in the future where a game comes along or some type of entertainment comes along and it's going to be a must-have. What that entertainment is going to look like, I don't know. And when that point in the future is, I wish I knew, but I don't.
Yeah. What about a funny or odd story from working in the industry? And I'm sure you've got a ton of them.
I do recall going into a Take-Two office in Singapore, and they'd opened this office there, and they had at the beginning door handles shaped like AK-47s. They had a big light in the meeting room that was shaped like an AK-47, and it's sort of like, okay.
Wow.
it's kind of like a little bit too, I don't know.
A little gratuitous there. There was like a light in the background that was shaped like an AK-47.
No, the light over the boardroom table, the whole length of the boardroom table was like shaped like an AK-47 and had like, you know, lighting inside it. So it was this big box shaped like an AK-47 with white Perspex underneath it that shone down. And it was kind of a little bit over the top. I have met the odd game executive kind of behaves like, the characters in the games themselves.
Yeah, right. gangster, thugs, all that kind of,
I think we've all met them.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
So, you know, and I think, you know, it's odd because gamers are sort of kind of, when they play games, it's very kill or be killed. And I wonder sometimes how that translates into the way we do business with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
no, I'm sure it has some sort of impact.
Yeah. Is there any games you're playing right now that you're excited about?
As I mentioned before, we've just signed a game called Dark Fracture. Now, Dark Fracture was a game, you could find it on Steam, actually. There's a prologue on Steam that was designed by one gentleman. It's an Unreal game, Unreal Engine. Yeah. And he's done the demo and the vertical slice all by himself, and it's spectacular. Wow. So the downloads on the demo at the moment is almost 230,000. A little past 230,000, and he's got 735, I think, mostly positive or overwhelmingly positive reviews. It's a really, really great game. Obviously, I haven't played through the whole game because it's not finished yet.
Yeah, where's the developer based out of?
Israel.
Oh, wow.
So Israel has a very, very small game development community. So there's another game coming out of there this year called In Sound Mind, and another a platformer called Grime, which is coming out of there, which looks pretty interesting. So they do have like a game design school, game design college there, which is part of the University of Technology. So there's a whole scene that's percolating out of that part of the world. So
I've heard that from other people too, that there was nothing, and it's kind of grown and it's kind of blossomed more here in the last 5 years. And it makes sense too, because there's so much tech developed in Israel that you have that tech foundation, and then people that want to, you know, use it for a different application and towards gaming. So no, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so if you can check out Dark Fracture Prologue, and I think you'll be equally as impressed. So, and the other thing that I've seen lately that that I'm really excited about is, you know, Deadhouse Sonata, which is developed by a studio in Canada, I think called Apocalypse. And then that's headed up by Dennis Dyack, we mentioned earlier as when we were talking offline, Legacy of Pain maker. He's got some amazing technology that he's working on. And you know, I'm really excited to see what they do with that, because it's a really, really bizarre concept of a game where, you know, you kind of play the bad guys. And it's going to be a free-to-play open world. It's just going to be a mind-blowing game. So really kind of excited about that. It's got nothing to do with Fear Demic, by the way. That's just kind of one that I've sort of come across in my travels. My team has played over 100 games so far this year. So and that 100 vertical slices and a demo. So, you know, we're sort of turning the world upside down all the time, looking for new ideas and new stuff. And there's some really amazing stuff out there. And a lot of clever ideas.
So where can people find you online? Like website, Twitter, things like that?
Feardemic.com.
Okay.
Feardemic.com or feardemicgames.com or feardemic.com. Doesn't matter. Both, if you go both
you
ways, you'll get the same place.
There you go.
We've got all the URLs. So that is the best place to find us. You can find us, of course, on all the social media platforms and oddly, most recently on TikTok. And it's our most successful or our fastest growing platform at the moment.
Really?
But that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah. Last question. Like, what's one piece of advice you would give others working in the industry right now?
Be thankful that you're working in the games business, and because it has really been a tough ride for a lot of people. And you know, be generous with your time and support of those who aren't as fortunate as we have been. And I think that's kind of basically about it.
Yeah, no, that's a very good perspective, because we are very fortunate to be in this industry and to be able to work remote. And I think sometimes people take it for granted and they don't realize how well we have it compared to all the other suffering and all the other people that have to do crazy stuff and deal with this pandemic and everything. So no, that's great advice.
Thank you very much for your time. And I should perhaps preface the whole discussion with, you know, I am working at home, so sorry about the noise.
It's part of the times here, right? It's like, thanks, Scott. I've enjoyed having you on and having your perspective.
Thank you for your time. I'm really, really pleased to be here, John. And you know, anytime you want to talk, I'm always available.
Cool. Thanks. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. Go to the website at gamedevadvice.com and you can find the show notes along with show notes for all the other episodes. Please also check out the new Patreon page at patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Have a lot of options up there for how you can support the show. Again, that's patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Thanks again for listening and being part of the show. Take care. Bye-bye.
Can you not get your keyboard so hard?
But I'm playing Minecraft.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.